Welcome to the Vanderbilt University Center for Teaching podcast, part of the center's efforts to cultivate dialogue about university teaching and learning among faculty, students, and staff. I'm your host, Rhett McDaniel, educational technologist here at the center. In this episode, we feature comments edited from a discussion held by three panelists: Bonnie Dow from Communication Studies, Ken Shriver from Physics and Astronomy, and Michelle Solikowski from Chemistry. In this session, each panelist talks about how they design and grade assessments that foster student learning and engagement while demanding academic excellence. We join the discussion as they share how they strive to balance generous support of student learning needs with requirements that drive their further achievement.
From the Department of Communication Studies, which is a humanity within the College of Arts and Science. In my department, we teach things like rhetoric, persuasion, debate, argument, the history of public discourse. So we have a lot, in fact, almost all of our courses are writing intensive, or they include writing, and then we have some that are really writing intensive. And because I knew before I came that I was the only humanist on the panel, I decided to focus on how to evaluate papers, because they tend to present the biggest difficulty, which I think is clear from what many of y'all have said. But I'm also sort of impressed at how many scientists we have here, because I actually thought the room would be full of humanists, because I always feel like we're the ones that people think, you know, have the trouble with grading. And I've been teaching for 20 plus years now, and I feel like it really is just fairly recently that I've gotten a pretty good handle on how to grade papers. Now, I actually believe my strategy at coming at rigor and grading papers is really to focus on the A-B distinction, and I'll tell you why. I think those are the most difficult distinctions we draw. Sometimes people, when they're told your grades are too high, what they think first is, oh, I need to give more C's, you know, because C's will bring my distribution down. I actually find that it's been most productive for me to really, really focus on the distinction between A papers and B papers. Because when you are able to reserve the A category for papers that are really exceptional, that is, that are truly innovative, really well expressed, insightful in their analysis, that is, and that, you know, they're just simply more creative and say something that may even surprise you, you know, which can be a difficult thing to do, right, if you've been teaching the same class for a long time, then the B category becomes reserved for those papers that are really competent, what you can call ordinarily good papers. Like, they're good in an ordinary way. Those are B papers, but I think that lots of times, and I certainly have done this myself, we give A's to those papers because we think, well, you know, we can check all the boxes. They did what we asked them to do, but in fact, you know, if they didn't do it with some kind of flair, you know, or some sort of distinction that you take notice of, then really it's not an A paper, at least in my mind. So here's what happens. If you focus on exacting standards for earning an A, then your grades will actually realign all the way down, because here's what tends to happen. Once some papers are pushed down to the B range because they're competent but not outstanding, then some papers that used to look like Bs will start to look like Cs, because you won't feel okay about putting the paper that did a decent job but had no flair, which perhaps used to be an A minus but really should be a B, in the same category as the paper that ignored part of the assignment, which perhaps used to be an offense that didn't even kick it out of the B category, but now it's clearly a C. Do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But really, I think the hardest distinctions for us to make, particularly with the students, or at least in my experience, with the students in the Vanderbilt undergraduate population, the hardest distinction is figuring out the difference between an A and a B. And if you're able to do that, then the other stuff starts to realign.
Great. We're going to have Ken speak next.
So my responsibility in the Department of Physics and Astronomy is for the general physics labs, which are the large introductory courses taken by all of our engineers, science majors, pre-meds. In addition to that, I periodically lecture, teach the Physics 110 course, which is introductory physics for non-science majors. And my approach to grading in both of these courses is very different. I have very different responsibilities, and my contact with the students is different. So I had prepared for my teaching assistants. I have 30 lab sections and 19 teaching assistants that are working for me this semester. And to comment again on what Gil mentioned, my teaching assistants come from places like China and Puerto Rico and Mexico and Iran And I find that there are cultural differences in grading, approaches to grading, that I need to address before classes start. And so, to echo what Bonnie just said, the first thing I do in preparing the syllabus and in reviewing with my teaching assistants is to emphasize that expectations really need to be defined and made clear. I also was impressed with the caliber of the students here at Vanderbilt when I first came into contact as an instructor with these undergraduates, and also impressed at their confidence and in approaching the instructor to question the grading. And I realized that my graduate teaching assistants, who were just undergraduates 6 months ago, were easily intimidated. Many of our graduate students came from schools that very different than Vanderbilt. So I realized that the way to approach it, at least for me, large lecture course here at Vanderbilt, is to define those expectations, to tell students what this course is about and what aspects will be emphasized and will be evaluated. Now, I have an advantage in the lecture course because, for most of us in this room, instructor and evaluator are one and the same person, as they are when I teach my 110 lecture. In the lab, I have the advantage that I can actually separate those functions, much like they might do at Oxford. You have the evaluations I'm responsible for. The instruction and the advocacy is accomplished with the teaching assistant who's in the laboratory. And I tell the students, I meet with every section of the labs the first week of classes, and I tell them that. We have different roles, and that the responsibility for learning the physics is with the teaching assistant, but that everybody's going to be evaluated according to the standards that I set for the course, and these are what they are. As it turns out, the way things work in my course, and I think it's consistent in the department, the lab reports, which are graded by the teaching assistants, typically average about 95%. The exams multiple choice tests that I prepare, typically average 70 to 75%. They're weighted equally in the course. The average in the course comes out right in the mid-80s, and the ship, we're sailing smoothly. We're sailing smoothly. And we have a reasonable distribution, but in my lecture course, because I'm both instructor and evaluator, I approach things a little different. I have different priorities. So I'm interested in evaluating their ability to understand how things work and their ability to apply some quantitative reasoning. I tend to use exams quite heavily. I use homework only as practice, but 80% of the grades are from the exams. And I write exams. I do not use multiple choice exams generally in my large lecture course. I have a mixture of short answer and essay questions where I do include the ability to express oneself in a test environment, to be able to write coherently and answer a question in that environment as part of that course. So once I've set those expectations and I tell the students that, then the design of the assessments, I ask myself whenever I'm writing a question for the exams, whether it's in the lab or the lecture course, what am I evaluating or what am I assessing here? And so I typically break that down into assessing the ability to analyze, the ability to apply newly learned skills to unfamiliar problems. One of my goals is that the students who come out of the course not only will have some new knowledge about how the world works, but that they'll be able to share that knowledge with others, or to be able to pick up a New York Times article and read the science section and have some familiarity or be able to relate what they're reading to some foundational knowledge that I've covered. A couple of things that I've learned here at Vanderbilt: I believe in hard floors and soft ceilings. By telling the students, if you get 94%, you have an A, there's a lot of discussion alleviated. Now, I say a soft ceiling because at the end of the semester, it might be that 93.5%, in fact, turns out to be the A in the course. But that's not determined until the end of the semester, and it's whether it's in the lab course where it's in consultation with the different teaching assistants, and I look for how well the students did on their tests, and I look at the ratio of their test scores to their lab scores. I try to emphasize to students that the grades are not arbitrary. The one of the big words that I had to get used to hearing when I first started teaching was fair and fairness. And so I have gone to some effort to make it clear to students that in the physics labs, the grading is fair. The tests, I give a common test to all 15 sections. We start at and I give 6 tests a semester. I spend probably 7 to 10 hours on each test creating 3 different versions with different versions of the question. I randomize and I tell students that I randomize. And then when the tests are given, I make sure the questions have all been vetted by the TAs so that they can support that this is a fair question, that they in fact did cover the material in their sections. In the lecture course, I definitely include more subjective assessments because I use those really to find out what the students, how the students are doing. So I think, again, by letting the students know what those expectations are and then showing them throughout the course that you're sticking to that really helps. So.
Okay. I'm Michelle Solikowski. I'm an instructor in the chemistry department. And most semesters I feel a little schizophrenic because I teach the large organic chemistry lecture for the anxiety-ridden pre-med students. And I also teach a freshman writing course for 15, and they're two very different beasts, so they have different requirements. I do have a reputation as being a difficult instructor, and I'm surprised that year after year the freshmen still continue to come back to my course. But I think a lot of it has to do with how you set the stage for the students, and I think Bonnie and Ken have both talked about having high standards that are unwavering, and students know them up front. And if you just stick to your guns and you're nice about it, you can get away with a whole lot. As long as students believe that you have their best interest at heart, that you really want to help them learn, that you want them to be successful, and that you're providing them with the tools to be successful, they'll pretty much accept whatever you give them. Okay, I think most of the students here are very responsive when you tell them exactly what you want. Not what's on the test, but exactly what you expect them to be able to do. They're highly responsive. So I really look in terms of grading with rigor, in terms of setting the stage so the students can go ahead and accomplish what they need to accomplish for that course. So if I think about rigor in my writing seminar, it's about having clear expectations and high standards that continue to rise throughout the year. So you set the high standard first, and then you tell them when they get their paper back that that's not going to be acceptable for the same grade for paper two. And you move them up the ladder. But I do, unlike Bonnie, use a rubric that I give to them before we actually begin writing the paper that clearly outlines all of the expectations for that paper. I find that for writing assignments, I get better work from students if they have some choice over the topical area that they're going to write about. So I'll give them a broad area. You have to write on one of the 3 content modules that we covered in this section of the course. Second section of course, you have to cover something vaguely related to the second content module. So in order to manage this without going nutso, we do lots of hand-holding in that first walk up to writing a good paper. So what I'll do for them is they have to submit a topic for approval that has 3 or 4 sentence description of what that topic is. And once it's approved, they have 4 days to write a detailed outline of what's going to be in that paper and provide an annotated bibliography with references for each of the sections in the paper, with the understanding that they may not use those references at all once they begin to write the paper. So you're trying to get them to actually think about things before they begin writing, which makes my job a lot easier. So when we get the outline in, I can sit there and say, have you thought about this? This is a bad idea. Why do you think that? Could item A be connected to item B? And then look at the references that they give with you and point them in the right direction. After this, they have to submit a first draft to their peers, and it's all open. It's on OAK. Everybody can see your work. Once everybody can see your work, the quality gets much better. Now, I don't post the grades of students' papers, because that would not be okay. But you can look at somebody else's paper that you're peer reviewing and see your quality versus their quality. So they have very detailed rubrics for reviewing each other's papers. And when I go to read the first draft, I read the students' peer reviews first, and then I pre-read the paper. So this saves me half the time because they'll start popping up on things, and I just won't look for those. I'll just say I agree with everything that your peer reviewers have said, and I'll just go through, look for something different, look for big picture items, gaps. And then they get to submit a final draft. They don't get any grades for outlines and bibliographies and first drafts. It's only the final paper so that we don't have any of this discussion about, but my paper improved so much, which it did, but we're all about the final paper. And even for the A papers that we'll give, there's always critical analysis for everything you do. Lots of praise, but just because I gave you an A doesn't mean your paper's perfect. So let me show you how to fix it for the next time. And one of the things that I let students in the course know in a joking way, but in a very serious way, is I really don't care what they think. I only care what they think in the context of what other people in academics have said. So that really helps them to move beyond, but it's my opinion, and I support it my opinion, but at that point, it's an opinion. And in college, we don't do opinions. We do thoughtful discussions. So just trying to bring them above and beyond what they would normally think about in terms of high school writing papers. In terms of the organic lecture class, I think, again, it's in terms of setting the stage for these students. Tell them you're loved, that you want them to be successful, and that you're going to give them the tools that they need to be successful. And be genuine about it. And they will respond very well to this. I do provide examples of what testing would look like. And many years ago, I thought giving out sample exams was just terrible. Until I realized that every frat and sorority had 5 or 6 years of my exams, and if you weren't in one of those, then you were actually disadvantaged. We are pretty firm in terms of grading. Like Ken, hard ceiling, soft floor. I just tell them I never give a curve. And I always do. But as soon as you tell them that there's wiggle room, they're like a good 16-year-old, and they're going to learn how to maximize that wiggle room. What I do in terms of assessments for the students, we typically will have no more than 5 or 6 multiple choice questions, and the rest will be open-ended questions. So in terms of making exams that I think the students can manage well, we like to have about a third of the exam be at the bottom of Bloom's taxonomy, you know, regurgitation, memorization, basic concepts, did I get the big picture, okay? And we like to put those at the beginning of the exam so that the student can go ahead and build some competency and confidence as they're going through the exam. Then we let them know that about a third of the exam is going to be questions that contain 2 or more concepts that are being put together in a unique way. Okay, a little more rigorous, but if they step back and think about it for a minute or two, they should be able to get it. And then maybe there'll be a third of the exam, maybe a little bit less. That should be highly challenging to them. Our normal class average is about a 75. And we like to have one exam that's really kind of low, usually in the low to mid-60s. And another exam maybe that's in the low 80s. That would be the high score on the exam. Okay? And I like to have one exam that's a little lower because it separates the wheat from the chaff and makes the end of semester grading a little easier. The one thing I think that works best for me, and I'll stop with this, is in terms of student complaints about grading. So what I have these students do for me is I will take any regrade request that you have. This is what you have to do. On a separate sheet of paper, you have to write down what you want me to regrade and why you want me to regrade it. So you can't say, I should get 10 points for problem 12. No. Why should you get 10 points for problem 12? Why was your answer right? Explain it to me in a paragraph or less. And I only get out of maybe 185 students, maybe 10 regrade requests per semester, because once they sit down and start writing it out, they realize they're wrong. And it really cuts down on a lot of back and forth between faculty and student that's not productive.
That was Bonnie Dow, Ken Shriver, and Michelle Sulikowski. You can view the show notes as well as leave comments or questions about this episode by visiting cft.vanderbilt.edu/blog/podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on this topic, we encourage you to stop by our website and join the discussion. Vanderbilt instructors are welcome to call the Center for Teaching at 322-7290 to arrange a meeting with a CFT teaching consultant to talk about grading for your class. Thanks for listening to the Vanderbilt University Center for Teaching podcast. I've been your host, Rhett McDaniel.